session number 10012, reel number 7.
Mr. George Clayton, reel 7. I wonder if you could tell me how you got on with your NCOs during this early period, your non-commissioned
officers. Well, we had two Welsh sergeants. One Sergeant Murphy, he was a gentleman. Couldn't describe him as anything else. But we had another one, O'Connor. He was a devil. He was indeed. Even his own mates, officers, couldn't get on with him. And he certainly couldn't get on with the man. He would call me for nothing. He wouldn't. It was there.
What sort of things did he call?
He'd been a regular soldier, and he'd been out there with the British Expeditionary Force. He went out there when the war force began, you know. But he was, there wasn't a good thing to be said about him. Even his own sergeant mates, they couldn't get on with him. There's two different types of Irishmen, but speaking generally, I would say the NCOs and officers were good. Couldn't describe them as anything else. No.
Who actually told you what to do day by day? Was that the officers or the NCOs?
Well, we had a sergeant major. He was the big noise, you know. And when you win your billet, of course, when you win in the trenches, well, it come down to the corporals. They were in charge of a party, you know. That, but I could only say this, that that was the only man I could ever complain against, was that Sergeant O'Connor. And he's a dreadful man. A real Irishman. Well, you know, you hear quite a lot about the behaviour that's in Ireland just now, and has been for some time now. But I could sort of understand it, if there's a lot of them like what that Sergeant was, O'Connor. But Sergeant Murphy, well, he was a gentleman. Couldn't say anything else. Listen to what he had to say, and an NCO, he ain't find a fault about nothing, because he's that way inclined. But this other one, Murphy, he was I never knew him put anybody in the peg at all. I never knew. And yet this O'Connor,
What about the officers? Can you remember anything about each of the officers?
Yes, I would say the officers were good. There was Lieutenant Greener. He was.
When did he come into it?
Beg your pardon?
When did Greener arrive?
Oh, he arrived after we were there. He was transferred from the infantry.
He was
really a territorial. And he went out early in the war, you know, the territorials did. And I think it was with him having his men and tickets that there had been some operation until June of 1915. The war began in 1914. And it was then that the main companies were being formed. You see, the Germans started that first.
Yeah.
And we had to get together, and then that's how the notice came to be put on the Charlie Pitt Heap that miners were urgently wanted.
What about Greener, though? What do you remember about him as a man?
Oh, a fine chap, Greener. He was and I was working at these collieries where his father was the agent of these collieries, you know. He lived in a big hall down here, Orpeth Hall. That was his residence. He's dead now, and Greener's dead too. I learned that when we were at that affair that wasn't done, you know. Yes.
Are there any stories you can tell us that would help illustrate what Martin Greener's character was like? Anything you can remember?
He was a good fella. Couldn't describe him as anything else. No, I never found anyone that had a complaint against him. There was a hot one, Firebrace, they called him. When we first went out, they took us as near to the Germans as they could, you know, right at the front line trench where we were going to tunnel. That meant there wouldn't be so much tunneling underground. We wanted to be underneath the German trenches. And, they took up there, and he says, the first party of us that did go out, and he says, we'll sink our shaft here. That was in the...
Is this the Australian officer?
No, he was... Yes, he was an Australian
officer.
He's
the one who told you off for not being able to sink shafts, is he?
We said we'd never done any sinking. He says, you call yourselves miners and you've never done any sinking? No.
What about Cassells? Do you remember him?
Oh, Cassell, he was one of the fine chap. He was one of the founders of the company, Cassells and Lum, and John Warnock. Them was the three officers we had when we first began.
What do you remember about... Is there any stories you can remember about any of them, or anything that happened that would show us what they were like?
Well, I couldn't make up any... Firebrace, well, of course, being an Australian miner, you know, it's all the different to what they do in this country, whether the chef put right down to the fine
coat. Yes.
They maybe strike a vein, as they call a vein, and then follow that on the surface, you know. It maybe start from the surface, and then... deep, but it's not like sinking a shaft. No.
So you liked all the officers then?
Hey?
You liked all the officers that you had at that time, that you had most
well,
to do?
Well, I... Oh, there was one... he was a tower. What is his name now? But, he always had somebody on the peg. And for practically nothing as well. And even his own mates, his officers, they couldn't agree with him. No, he was...
What about the commander of the company?
The commander? Oh, there was a... First one we had was Major Carlyle. No, they couldn't... They're all majors, the command officers of all the tunneling companies. And there's a major...
What was he like?
Oh, I couldn't complain about him. No, but although there was one I know, the officers didn't like him. No, he was jolly hot on the officers. He was more hot on the officers, I think, what he was on the men. I've heard the officers complain about him. And there was some decorations he got, you know, and as I've said, the ones who was conspicuous mainly were Freemasons. No one of the lads. But
was Greener or Cassells or Warnock, were they in the Masons?
I think Greener was. I couldn't say for Warnock now. But or Lum either. But Greener was a Freemason. And he was they formed the themselves a sort of a clique, you know. I walked in the officer's mess at one time, and I used to see how they behaved. Well, we'll get under strength in officers. They're like everybody else. Some got wounded, and some went sick, and some died, and were killed, or something. And then there had to be an officer come to make up the strength of the company, do you see? Well, they used to go to the railhead. We had a man used to drive a light car, and when there was a new officer coming, there'd be wired on that a certain officer was leaving, you know, and they'd get a bit of idea what time they expect them to arrive in the rail station. That was as far as they could go, but you see, but you could go for miles after that before you reach the trenches. And, you could find they used to bring them, the officer that went with the car, the light car, to bring them up. When he got them to the mess, he'd bring them in and introduce them to the fellow officers, and it wasn't long before he got the Masonic sign, you know. I said, "What have you done with it?" I'm not a Mason, but I knew what it was, and if he was a Mason, he was one of the lads. "Oh, come here." I was walking on the mess at the time, and the missus said, "Get a bit drink, a glass of whiskey, Clayton. If he was a Mason, get him a double glass of whiskey." But if he wasn't, well, you could see he was shelled. I didn't like Freemasonry for that, because the man that was a Mason, he was really nursed, you know, and when it was his turn to go to the trenches, there was every bit of instruction given to him, then the plans to show the trenches you have to go into, you know, when you went B4 trench, be very careful at that length from A to B, there's a sniper plane on there, and whatever you do, keep your head down.
So Greene was very much involved in that, was he?
Oh, Greene, he was an old company, I would think, right from almost its formation, certainly up to lie.
But he was one of the ones who were most enthusiastic about Freemasonry in the mess, was he?
I wouldn't say he was the most enthusiastic, but he was a Mason. He was one of the lads, and
what about Cassell?
Oh, Cassell, he was a Mason. Johnny Warnock wasn't.
Who do you think started this up? Because it's not that common in the army. Who do you think was at the centre of this Freemasonry of the officers? Who was the one who started it up, or who's the one who made it important?
I couldn't see who was the big lad of the noise. The adjutant was usually the big noise among the officers, you know, what they call the adjutant. He was the one. No, I think Greener was an adjutant one time, and then we remember another one, but he was a terror, even among the officers. They didn't like him.
You don't remember his name, though?
Of course, I think he used to issue the instructions to them when they had to go up to the trenches and what part of the trenches they had to go to, you know. And through that, well, I think he didn't please the officers, I know, and he certainly didn't please the men. Because, I remember once, I had to lead them. Oh, there'd been some trouble. There's one of the saps. We always call the main saps there, you know.
Where was this at?
Yeah, down the sap. And it had got flooded. We'd had a lot of rain, and the men wouldn't go in because they said it wasn't fit to walk in. Well, I think it was Pryor. They called this adjutant. And
what did he say?
Pryor, I think, P-R-I-O-R, Lieutenant Pryor. And, I had to, he was in the billet, and they must have weighed word down, somebody must have weighed down to the headquarters that the sappers weren't able to go into the sap due to being flooded with water. And he came up, and I had to lead him, take them to where the sap was, the part of the trench. They say he'd never been there before, and when he got near to where the sap was, where the men were quartered, he drew out his revolver and he went in among the men with his revolver. I never saw anybody do that, just him among the men that he was under, you know. it was to scare them. He was telling them that they would have to go through the water. And I think he did scare them. They got in somehow, though, but it certainly wasn't fit to go into, because you see, there was just hand pumped to get the water out, and the water's coming in faster than the pump could go, as fast as the pump could deal with it, you see. It would have had a lot of rain, but anyhow, I don't know, I couldn't tell you really what did happen, but I think the men, I think he scared them. They got through the water somehow or other and got into it.
Which sap was that? Do you remember where that was?
Where?
Which sap was that?
Oh, I couldn't tell you. It was in Sanctuary Wood. That's all I know. But I couldn't tell you which one it was, because there was...
Is this early on?
There was different companies operating these mines, you know. And one time we were in competition with one another. It was what they called a footage. They say that the main got the most footage out, they're the ones that got a larger warm ration. And that meant a lot of competition between, because you know, a lot of the miners like rum, they'll do anything for rum, and it was the real Mackay, I may tell you, the rum there. It was all in a gallon stone jars, and it had the letters on SRD. I think that would be for Service Rum Distillery. That's where it came from. But it was everybody got a ration of rum. But when that competition was on, they would give a double ration to rum if you beat the other ones that was mining next to you, you know. If you had got more footage out, as they called it, well, you were worth a big ration of rum. And some jolly funny things done, you know, to get rum out there. I could tell you some funny stories about rum. It was the real Mackay. But you... It wasn't done to proof, you know. It was false proof. Okay. And you could stand the cold, or it put new energy into you when you got that. I've never tasted anything like it, even from the rum bottles here. They couldn't touch the...
Would the rum make you drunk?
Eh?
Would it make you drunk, a double rash?
Oh, drunk. It'd make you sleep, too. You could sleep. Oh, you slept like a top. In fact, I knew one fella. We had one, he was a corporal in our company, he stole a rum jar.
He what?
He stole one, and he got that much of it, and he slept outside. That made him he lost the use of his legs with the much of it, you know. He was dead the next morning. He was frozen to death. He had a big family of kiddies as well. I think he came from Staffordshire. I forget his name now, but he died... getting an overdose of rum.
You said there were all sorts of tricks pulled to get rum. Can you remember any of them? How people would try and get it?
Well, it had that incentive where if you beat all your other companies, it was tunneling, or maybe the same company had two tunnels going, or maybe three tunnels going at the same time, you know, and. The one that had the most footage, that they got the biggest ration. Yes, they'll maybe get an extra ration.
You took your rum ration, did you?
Yes, I took my rum ration.
Did you ever manage to get any extra?
Well, I have got extra. And the old fellow pinched some, and he was very friendly with me, and... He says, get yourself some of this. In fact, I had my water bottle filled when I was coming home once on leave on service. I remember getting it home, and there's a few pals, you know, a young fella then. Some were left here still working on the colliery. We got together and, by Jove, Oh, we had a right sing-song after we got that. But it was a wonderful thing, I think, at home. I would think it saved many men's life in winter time because, you know, it was sometimes difficult to go to sleep on account of the cold. But if you got a glass of warm, it didn't matter what you were sleeping on, you could sleep with us because it was, oh, very good. Yes, all day.
Would many people get drunk on it? Would many people get drunk on it?
Would many people get drunk on it? If they got plenty of it, they'll get drunk.
But not a normal ration?
Well, maybe some that wasn't used to it, you know, they were more easily overcome than what the one was that had been used to it before he got into the army, you know, we had those men. But it was, I would say it saved many men's life at home there. Yeah, I will say that because there's nothing you could get out in civilian life that would equal the stone jar rum that they showed the soldiers with. Yeah.
After you'd blown up the Hoo Chateau positions, what did you do then? What was the 175 put on working then?
Oh, we still kept on tunneling. We went more to the right, more into Hill 60. And,
what were you doing there?
But this was later on, Hill 60. We went away to the summer and then came back to, we walked on Hill 60 again. We walked 6 months on the Berlin Tunnel.
When was that?
The Berlin Tunnel. It was blown up when Messines Ridge was blown up.
What year did you work on it?
No, what year would be Messines went up?
Oh, it was
1670. I think it would be the year 17. There was a lot of other mining companies went away. We didn't complete that tunnel on the Messines Ridge. We walked at it 6 months. From Hill 60, it wasn't a mine, it was on a hillside, you know, a hill where the railway it cut through it, you know, and we drifted in from the side. Well,
what was your starting point? Do you remember?
The starting point, no.
Was it by railway embankment?
It was a railway embankment at Hill 60, near Hill 60. There was a railway, I think it was, of course it went through the German lines, it continued on from there.
This was a drift type, Ryan, was it? So you just went...
Yes, we just drifted in the hillside, and we were 2 miles... No, a mile past the German front line when we left it. There was a team of Australian miners. They completed the job. It was the Messines Ridge.
Could you tell me something about the digging of the Berlin Tunnel? What problems were you faced with there?
Well, I couldn't say about a great deal of problems. I think it would be merely pick and shovel work. We put a railway down, and all the sandbags were filled. They were put onto the truck, you know, and it was good for. It saved all the dragging of bags, and it was quicker to where you could probably get 40 or 50 bags onto a iron bogey, as we called it, you know. There was on wheels and on rails. It was easier to go in, empties to get in, and full ones to come out, with being on wheels. on the wheel bogie, you know, do you see?
And we could probably
put about 20 or 30 bags onto this bogie and bring it out with one run, where otherwise it was quicker than dragging them out by hand.
Was it powered, was this railway line powered, or did you just pull it along the tracks?
We pushed it.
Pushed it
along, you know. There would only be about 4 feet in height. And men, you were doubled over, but you were pushing them with the tubs at the colliery, you know, the putters. Yes.
What was the tunnel like, the Berlin Tunnel? What did it look like? Was it close timbered?
Oh, yes, all the way, bottom, sides, and top. And there was at the top, you know, there was and the other one had the tongue on it, do you see? And that meant a joint that it fitted into. And you could put that up without making any noise, or very little noises. You know. It didn't need any hammering, you know, as they often do in timber where noise doesn't matter. You give it a knock to knock it in, but this could really be put in and sort of loose, but it fastened itself, you know, as the earth fell around it. And it was once you'd got it timbered right top, bottom and sides, there was no more earth to remove. Like if it had only been timbered at intervals, you know, as there sometimes is at a pit, there's maybe 2 yards between one pop and the next one. But with being close jointed timber and all the way around, there was no more earth fell in, you see. It was sealed up that way, you know, timber and box, like being in a box.
Now, your job on this tunnel, you were a tunneler's mate, weren't you?
I was a tunneler's mate, yes.
Could you just compare the two jobs? What did the tunneler do and what did the tunneler's mate do?
Well, the tunneler's mate, his usually was to convey the, get the earth away that he was digging out, you know, digging loose. You had to hold the bags for him to fill for you. And you also had to drag them out, and get up to the shaft bottom, and then they were hauled up by the windlass, you know, like a windlass on a well, you know, and them gawkers was at the top, they would wind it up.
but not on the Berlin Tunnel, because that was
dreadful. Oh, no, in the Berlin. Well, it all came out on rail. Yeah. And as I say, when we left it...
Was your job then to get the dirt out, to bag it up, and then get it onto the railway thing? Would you put the timber up as well, would you, behind him?
Well, it was usually it was the tunneler, really, that put he put the timber on in, and the tunneler's mate, well, he would bring it, help him, you know, bring see that he was supplied with timber, and see that a lot of the sandbags that was filled were taken away, you know, to the shop bottom.
Would he ever take a turn at digging? Would you ever take a turn at digging?
Oh, yes, I've taken a turn at digging, but you see, it was sometimes mostly unfair. There were some fellas There were 6 shillings when they came out, and other fellas there had been promised 6 shillings, and they didn't get it. And at one time that made a bit of trouble, at all one. They wanted it put into the pay books that there were 6 shillings, but there were just a 2 and 2 pence in the pay book. That's what they got, what was entered in your book when you enlisted. I think it was 2 and 2 or 2 and 4. I forget.
Did you resent it?
Beg your pardon?
Did you think you should get more pay?
Did I get more pay?
Did you think you should have done? Did you think you should have got the same as the tunnel?
Well, I couldn't say that I complained a great lot, because I worked a good while in the officer's mess, and he hadn't any mind to do it on that job, you know. You just had to cook the officer's meals. And
I'll come to that. But yeah. You worked on the Berlin Tunnel, though, didn't you?
Oh, yes, I worked on the Berlin Tunnel, yes.